this is where the right people come together to move issues forward and provide some solutions. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for the support. Peter O'Brien is, speaking of support, is one who has been so supportive of the City Club, of me personally, professionally, over so many years, and has mentored so many people in so many different ways. Philanthropy, business, civic engagement, hospitality industry, you name it. He is Chicago. Peter and his wife Mimi have dedicated so much in their family to helping remove and break the stigma that's associated with mental health and addiction. And it's really, as you'll probably hear from our special guest, Patrick Kennedy, it really has done an awful lot nationally. And Illinois has been at the forefront so much. And that's so much because of Peter. He's a longtime supporter of the City Club. And in fact, his generosity is on display physically, because every one of you is going to get a book on the way out as a gift from the O'Brien family. Thank you for that, Peter. There is a table of books, and please, on your way, well, don't go out. Go get the book. And then after the program, of course, and then come back in, because I think Patrick, as long as we can get him to his flight on time, is open to signing as many as he can. So thank you, Peter. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your support. I'd like to invite you up here to introduce our guest of honor, ladies and gentlemen, Peter O'Brien.
Mark Isherwood likes my shoes, so I'm in style. And by the way, Dan, I put away that 20-page speech that Mark Meraz from my operations gave me, and I only have a 10-minute speech here. But anyway, you know, so gratitude. I'll tell you that I have much gratitude for you, Dan. You have breathed such great modernized life into the City Club, and so congratulations. The City Club is a platform where civic and political and thought leadership inspires. Dan, you and the City Club board, Omar, thank you for your leadership, and all the staff, Amanda and all of the staff, embrace a great tradition and elevate presentation and discussion to a greater level of inclusion and impact. The guests and topic of today's presentation and discussion represent a challenge that faces this city, nation, and the world, and calls for all of our attention and our response. What do we know about mental illness and addiction? How do we overcome persistent stigma and ignorance so that when persons are impacted by illness of the brain, as if the brain is not part of our body, they receive the treatment and support they require and are entitled to? The best experts of this topic are the individuals with lived experience, telling us of their challenges, recovery, and resilience. From these experts, we can learn so much and build the empathy and will to demand more of our healthcare system to address the illness of the brain. It is my honor to introduce two individuals that exemplify those of lived experience and resilience to inform and to inspire us today. First, allow me to welcome to Chicago, and a big welcome to Philomena Quebec from Wisconsin here to Chicago. All right. Philomena, I'm going to bring you up in just a minute. Let me get to Patrick Kennedy as well. Philomena belongs to the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Philomena is an attorney and judge licensed to practice law in tribal and state courts, and has more than a decade of experience providing legal and policy services to tribal nations and individuals involved in domestic violence. Presently, Philomena is a PhD student and a Bloomberg Fellow at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Philomena is with us today as she is a profile in mental health courage. Chapter 1 of Patrick Kennedy's book is dedicated to Philomena's story of trauma, mental illness, and addiction, and her incredible recovery and resilience that brings us here today on our stage. Former Congressman Patrick Kennedy needs no introduction to Chicago. In fact, it's because his uncle won so many votes in Chicago in 1960 that we welcome him back every time with open arms. Former Congressman Patrick Kennedy is the nation's leading advocate and policymaker for mental health and substance use treatment. With the respect and involvement of behavioral health leadership in organizations throughout the country, Patrick has increased public understanding of what mental illness and addiction is, and he has taken action to ensure mental health rights and access for all of us. During his time in Congress, Congressman Kennedy was the lead author of the landmark Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. Like most of us, we had our fathers to help us, and so I know that his father, Senator Kennedy, was there to help him with that landmark bill. And it requires insurers to cover treatment for mental health and substance use disorders no more restrictively than treatment for illness of the body. As founder of the Kennedy Forum, he now unites, advocates, policymakers, and business leaders to advance evidence-based practices, and policies in mental health and addiction. Chicago and Illinois have played a significant role in the Kennedy Forum and continues on to be a leading state in the country, thanks to leaders like Senator Feigenholz and Robin Gable and Governor Quinn. When he was in office, he was the first one that I called to welcome Patrick to start our journey on the Parity Act here in Illinois. Patrick recently authored his second book, which, as Dan said, you're all going to be getting a copy today. We're going to be talking about now Profiles in Mental Health Courage, inspired by his uncle's book of 1956, Profiles in Courage, that most of us has read when we were in high school and beyond. As Patrick will tell you in a few minutes, this is a book for everyone. It's for those struggling with mental illness and addiction who often feel alone. It's for caregivers, family members, friends, and policymakers. By reading it, I can assure you, that you will gain a better understanding of mental illness and addiction. Patrick, thank you for being with us today. I want to tell you that Patrick and I first met after my wife Mimi and I and our daughters lost our son. I wandered home one day, and the TV was on, and I saw this kid from Boston talking in his Boston accent about the pejoratives of mental health and how we have to be resilient and that people that suffer with mental illness should get the respect of all of us. And so for a quick moment, I picked up the phone to call my son, and I knew at that moment that he was in heaven. So I called his cousin, Chris, and I said, Chris, I need your help because I just saw a profile in Courage. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you a couple of profiles in Courage. Patrick Kennedy and Philomena Quebec are going to be interviewed now by Dan.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter, for that introduction. I remember going to PJ's wake, I don't know, probably 10 years ago, maybe more, and I didn't know what to say. No one knew what to say. It was not, I didn't talk about it in Irish Catholic family. You know, we didn't get into much. And here we are about 10 years later, talking about mental illness, addiction, on the stage at the City Club. And it's thanks so much to, in part, to what so many of you in this room are doing, and especially with the platform of the Kennedy Forum and the partnership between the O'Briens and the Kennedys. Welcome to City Club. Patrick, welcome back.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
Philomena, welcome back to Chicago. If I understand correctly, you were born here.
I was born in Chicago.
Yeah.
Greatest city in America.
Oh. All right.
There
wow.
we go. All right, we're done. City Club is adjourned. Welcome back. We look forward to hearing more from both of you. And as Peter mentioned, when you get this book, the first chapter, which I actually read last night because I was able to pick up a book last night, is partially your story. And you've been so brave to share that. So we look forward to hearing more about it. Patrick, you are a father, you're a son, you're an advocate, you're an author, you're a Kennedy, you're a former congressman.
I'm a drug addict.
And an addict. You're an addict. How have you combined all of
those? Put it on the table here.
Put it out there. You've combined all of those titles, all of those adjectives, all of those positions to make something great of it. How have you been able to combine all those different facts of walks of life and people that you've met along the way into this incredible forum that's moving the ball forward on mental illness?
Well, thanks, Dan. So after my last DWI out of three, I very publicly shame went off to treatment. When I got back, I was stopped by colleagues of mine in the Congress that I had never really spent much time with, who all of a sudden wanted to introduce themselves and talk to me. And it occurred to me that I was the only person that they knew in the Congress amongst their colleagues that suffered from the disease of addiction. And I went on to meet dozens of my colleagues who had this illness run in their families. In fact, several of them were struggling themselves, one of whom, a senior Republican leader on the Energy and Commerce Committee, who couldn't get coverage as a member of Congress because the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan was denying reimbursement for his care. It was so ironic because I used to go for detox during my Christmas vacations because I figured no one would bother to ask where I had disappeared to during my Christmas vacations. Just shows the insidiousness of these illnesses is that I was still trying to manage my illness. If I could just get a little detox here, I could be back on the road, I could manage this. And he was doing the same thing. Mm. And I remember I was getting ready to take off on a flight, and I got his call, and I recognized him, and he said, "I just coming out of treatment. I need your help." So, and after I left Congress, and of course I thought my world had ended, and I lost my big job, lost all my staff, lost all my, you know, mojo, left Rhode Island, and left D.C. I got back and, you know, really focused on getting a permanent sobriety date. 5 years into recovery, I get a call from the Speaker of the House. And she said she wanted me to come back to Washington to do an intervention on one of my former colleagues. And when I left, I thought, what in the world can I do? My best days are behind me. You know, my future is in my past. Like, I couldn't imagine, what am I going to do now? No longer an office holder, no longer can. And then at that moment, I realized, no, I have a purpose, because they keep talking about it in 12-step recovery, that we shall not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it, because every one of us has a story that can be of help to someone else so that they don't feel as alone. And I told the president this. He did this big event with my family at the John F. Kennedy Library to launch his cancer moonshot. And you know that was
the
really
current president.
The President Biden, yeah, because of his losing his son Beau to cancer. And of course, my father always taught me, you got to get your message tight, You got someone important in front of you so that you don't miss this opportunity. So I already knew. So President Biden comes around, he comes up to me. I said, Mr. President, addiction is the new cancer. And he stopped for a second. He looked at me and then he leaned in. I got to get you Hunter's book. So, and by the way, my personal feeling is, I know we're already off topic, Dan.
Will you do that?
My personal feeling is I know a lot of the folks around the president say, Hunter Biden's a loser. They got to keep him at arm's length. And I have repeatedly contacted everyone I know in the White House and around him and said, Hunter Biden, his best chance of being reelected. Because what happens to millions of Americans every year with a family member suffering from these has happened to the first family. And it's an illustration that every single... There are millions of Americans who read Hunter's story and go, "That's I know that story because they have addiction in their family." And, you know, president has done so much for this cause. As you know, I mentioned the parody. He, with Marty Walsh, who's also in recovery, when he was Secretary of Labor, he helped start this new rule that is about to get released. And we'll do a lot to help bring some accountability in terms of the enforcement of parity. And, of course, the CCBHCs, which we're happy to work with the city in Chicago now on how to make the most of this new federal program for certified community behavioral health centers, which are like the FQHCs. They have prospective payment models, which means, as Mark knows, you're not waiting for a service to be delivered. You're proactive in treating these illnesses, so it's not all reactive, which is part of the problem with our whole system. But my point is that he's got so much to campaign. Of course, most people don't know about all of this, as they don't know most about what all that he's accomplished. But they'll know his son, and they'll know his experience as a father. And I've tried to say he can tie the fact that he's so outspoken on these issues to his own personal experience. And then he can tell them, you think you saw a moonshot for cancer in my first term for Beau? I'm going to show you something better in my second term for Hunter and all the other families out there in America who have addiction in their family, and he'll win this election. If that's the approach and he runs towards it, as opposed, just like Peter and Mimi, they could have easily, in the pain of their loss, you know, hidden. No one would have, as you said, no one would have pushed them on it. But because they ran towards the problem instead of away from it, they've changed law here in the state. I never would have come out. We would have never gotten the Kennedy Forum, Illinois. We never would have worked with the Senator Feigenholz and Gable. We would have never gotten specialty coordinated care, a mandate here in Illinois, if it hadn't been for that phone call from Peter O'Brien. So I should shut up now because I've said everything I need to say in this. And now, Philomena. So when I did this book, I knew, because we feel less alone if we read our stories in other people's stories. Now, they can be different because she's a member of the indigenous community. How do I know anything about that? She's had kind of personal violence, experienced personal violence and trauma in a way I haven't. But there are elements in all of our stories that we can identify with each other on. And that was the purpose of writing this book. And there's 12 other people, and by the way, their families, and I can tell you, everybody will read something into their own life's story in these 12 profiles. And I am so grateful for Philomena being willing to share her story, because it's still hard to tell a story and not have people judge you. Mm-hmm. But she's in the forefront of delivering care for people who are suffering just like herself. And that is the answer to all of our problems, and epitomized by President Kennedy's call to America to ask not what their country could do for them, but what they could do for their country. Because we all want purpose, Dan. And when we're in recovery, we're blessed because we have a chance to look out for others, because our own recovery depends on helping others. And when I called all these people, in spite of the difficulty, say, tell me everything shameful and embarrassing about your life as it relates to mental illness, she said yes. And her other 11 profiles said yes. And they did it because they want to make sure other people are benefited from understanding what these illnesses really look like, which we still don't know, honestly, because everyone today is fine saying, oh, I'm in recovery, but they won't really say much more than that, right? Let's just be honest. We've made some advances in stigma, but in this book, you're going to actually find out what it's like to live with these illnesses, and that we need, because most Americans, if you're not in 12-step recovery or if you don't actively participate in support groups within NAMI or any of the other great support alliances, you don't know what it really is like for people to cope with these illnesses, and that was the purpose for the book.
And how did you meet each of these? I mean, how do you meet?
I talked to everybody I knew in the field, and I said, I need heroes that you know. And then I went around and I sent them a letter, and then I asked for the call, and then I started down that road. And luckily, I could cut to the chase and end up with the real heroes, because I knew a lot of heroes already, and I knew if they said, oh, this is someone who'd be great for you to talk to, I already knew I was more than half the way there. And Michael Botticelli, who's the first person in open recovery to be drug czar in this country. Michael, and LGBTQ, and public, and very outspoken about the particular challenges that the LGBTQ community faces in terms of discrimination and frankly, suicide ideation. But and he said to me, you got to talk to Philomena. So I knew I was already in the winner's circle with Philomena when I first spoke to her.
Well, let's talk a little more. Are you willing to share some of that? Obviously, it's in the book, and Patrick appreciates that courage to share. I'd love for you to share what you're willing with us a little more about your personal story, because everyone has one, right? Different to different extremes, different levels. But we'd love for you to share a little bit about your story, chapter one.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here in company with such a great audience. So I was born in Chicago, and the day that I was born, my dad was in being hospitalized for a serious mental illness. My dad has bipolar disorder. And like I shared last night, my grandfather also had bipolar disorder and ended up dying because of it. My mom was alcoholic, mm-hmm. right? And so from my very first memories, my mom was really fun, but there was just so much chaos going right. on, right? And I had a very... So much chaos in my childhood, and you know, I ended up suffering from really some serious abuse that led to mental illness that started around age 12 with PTSD. And I remember being a 12-year-old kid going to school and going to sleep and going to school and going to sleep, and that's about when I had my first suicide attempt. And I really had never told anybody about this until I shared it for this book, because it's just not something that I talk about. And my family, so my grandma was born and raised on the Bad River Indian Reservation. Our tribe is lineal descent, and that means that, you know, as long as she was enrolled, I'm enrolled. So, you know, there's kind of questions about blood quantum and stuff, but that doesn't apply to Bad River. So I always knew that I was a Bad River tribal member, and my grandma emphasized education. You have to educate yourself. And she said, you never depend on a man. Educate yourself. Get the best education you can possibly have. You know, and I think that's really protective against things like domestic violence, which is rampant in like for tribal women, for American Indian women in this country. So I always worked hard at my education, graduating from, you know, from college with honors, and then I ended up going to law school and working really hard. And it was a very hard and isolating experience because I was the only Native person in my graduating class. And law school is really all about how they took all our stuff and how they keep it. And I struggled with my mental health in law school. It's very stressful. It's very isolating. Lawyers and law students have a higher than average rate of mental disorders and substance use disorders. A man from my class, actually, he lost his life to suicide. And, you know, and then I went to practice and got divorced from my husband and was single and all kinds of stuff. And I was ready to just go with my life. And then, you know, PTSD came back and you know, I've struggled with suicidality. I've struggled with just maintaining, you know, maintaining stress-free, but always trying to make progress. Because when I went to law school, I promised my grandma that I would help Indian people. That was my promise to her. I graduated in 2008 when there were no jobs and like the whole economy had gone down the toilet. And I kept praying and praying. I need this opportunity to make good on the promise that I made to my grandma. So I came back home and I worked for my people to protect our environment. And then I ended up in doing child welfare cases. And my whole caseload was children whose parents use drugs. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes that was the only indication of neglect. And what I realized in working all these cases is that we were just going through the motions. Kids would be removed, and then that was it. They would go with guardians, and moms and dads were left with no housing, no job, no health care, in jail, just devoid of all the resources they needed to get better. And without their kids.
Yeah.
Without their kids. And I knew that we had to do something different. I knew that we had to do something different. And as someone who very easily could have been in that same position, I will not rest. I will not rest until we do better for those parents and better for those kids. We have to interrupt these cycles of trauma because that trauma is so connected with the experience of substance use disorder, with mental health. I know that my symptoms would have been different, my experience would have been different if there had been better ways to connect me and help through the trauma, right? And so I'm absolutely committed to doing that for kids. Like I said last night, it's culture, connection, employment, education. Those are the things we have to focus on in tribal communities to make sure that we're protecting our children from everything that is coming at them. We are experiencing the most tremendous assaults in the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is second in the nation for the level of death among American Indian people from drug overdoses. This is not inevitable. Michigan is very different. Michigan's drug overdose rates for American Indians just are a hair's breadth away from that of white people. And so this is not about inevitability. It's about bad policy.
Yeah.
Wow. It's about bad policy.
Yeah.
We need to change things to make a difference for our people.
So this journey, you're on a journey and you're making progress, it sounds like. I would imagine telling your story is a big piece of that, right? And how did that feel once you got that out there and now it's actually in print? Are you feeling that you're moving forward?
I get calls from women from my tribe who are in jail a lot. And and we end up having conversations about, first we talk about how to get them out of jail. You know, it's usually just a simple thing that needs to happen. And then once you get out, how are we going to make sure that you stay safe? Because coming out of jail is the riskiest time for people who are opioid users. And so I want to know, dear, like, has anybody talked to you about medications or medications that can really reduce the risk when you come out? Because I want you to stay alive. And then they say, oh, I don't like medications. Like, I don't want to do that. And I'm like, I know. I don't like medications either.
Yeah.
And so then I can share my story about my own mental health experience and how I've needed medications during certain periods to reduce the risk of death. And I talk about my experience with suicidality. I talk about it with people. I talk about it with people who are in less privileged positions than I am, to help them understand that they are absolutely not alone, and that there are many, many people who experience risk associated with their mental health, and that it's okay to talk about, and like there are things that we can do to reduce that risk, to make sure that we're still alive, that we can live happy, functional lives. So there's so much stigma around medication.
Philmans, the thing is, we feel the sense of inevitability that we can't do anything about the rising suicide and overdose rates. And that is so wrong. But people are so overwhelmed with negativity and terrible stories that we just kind of feel like, I can't do anything. But there is so much we can do. When you first have an example of suicide ideation, you've self-harmed in an ER, we shouldn't just let people roll out the front door without giving them the cognitive behavioral therapy that can actually reduce their suicide ideation. So literally, with what we learn in recovery is how to practice thinking patterns and around acting differently to change our thinking. And the more we kind of work that, so we actually have evidence-based interventions which need to be introduced in the ER. Like you were talking about, we need to get buprenorphine so people don't OD when they're coming out of jail, because now they can go back to opioids, but their bodies have changed their tolerance level, and they go, and that's how they die. But so MAT, then you could do on the suicide, we could have cognitive behavioral therapy and get people wrapped in right away. So if you want to find who's at risk, they're people that have already shown up in these ERs. Like, it's not like this is inevitable or I never knew. No, no. If we think about it, we know we can stratify populations based upon risk level, which means this idea that we're just like going along like, oh, we could never intervene, never stop this is really defeatist. And it's really our biggest challenge is the attitudinal barriers that we have.
I was identifying a challenge just in hearing all of this, jotting down words, suicide, trauma, anxiety, bipolar, opioid, alcohol, medication, loneliness, PTSD.
But that's the problem, Dan. So our system just pays for those in silos. What we need to do is see, what does Philomena need? What does Patrick need? What does, you know, PJ need? What does a Josh need? You know what? They need different things, but they all revolve around three people. They need people to help support them. They need a place that's stable. They need a purpose in their life that gives them connection and validation and that sense of purpose. And then finally, we need payment models that pay for more than just the medical side. So when we passed the parity law, it was to equate reimbursement to the med surge, because we needed that as a way to get money. Because most mental health up till now has been financed through bake sales and philanthropy. We need to embed...
Or volunteers, yeah.
So we just need to build the benefit model that includes these social supports that are not reimbursable under health insurance today. And frankly, we're going to save not only insurance companies the cost of medical complications and, quote, total cost of care. We're going to save Cook County. We're going to save the city of Chicago. We're going to save the state of Illinois dollars. So what we need to do is get those government agencies, like first responders, like, you know, Cook County Jail. This has already been demonstrated in many other places. Let's just take a little piece of those dollars, because we're going to reduce the burden of all those other budgets if we go up front. And there's a way now to track, you know, frankly, on a population level rather than an individual level, the savings to various interventions. But we need to do a super premium. So we need to do a lot more on mental health and addiction. How do we do that? We get the payers to do more, but we also get the major employers, we get the state, because everyone will benefit. The problem is we don't see the total cost as one, or we could really easily say, oh, well, look at this cost when you accumulate all these. We know what we could do with those dollars in a lot more effective way, not only financially, but obviously for the human dignity of everyone suffering from this. So at the back of the book is a QR code to our alignment for progress. So that's a way of aligning policies, which, as Philomena said, involve criminal justice, involve housing supports, involve human services, involve health care. It's a whole lot. It's like FEMA. We have a natural disaster as real as those hurricanes and tornadoes. We need a FEMA. FEMA doesn't show up and say, oh, we just do, you know, insurance and housing. They show up and say, what do you need? Oh, you need food? Great. We'll take care of it. What else do you need? You need supportive employment? Great. What you need to rebuild? We'll take care of that too. Like, we need that kind of wraparound coordination amongst agencies and departments and government. And this is frankly the most exciting time in our history to do something about this crisis. Because people are engaged, but they want to know what to do. And what we're doing at the Kennedy Forum is giving them the answers to the test. And I always in school wanted the answers to the test before. So.
And you mentioned history. I mean, this, and I think history will treat this very kindly, and these efforts that you've made, because in looking at reading some of your book, Profiles in Courage was modeled after some incredible historical figures, the original book, right? And I didn't know some of these. John Quincy Adams, you know, there were people that had so many problems in their families, and just as you said earlier, everyone is affected by this, and this dates back who knows how long, right? But now, in just these few years, so much progress has happened. I believe, and I guess I would say this as more of a thank you, but I do hope everyone recognizes how much has come along in this short period of time, and how much of that is because of you and every people like this in this room. And there's going to be, you know, just in my sort of reflecting on it, civil rights, voting rights, gay rights, smoking in public places, that was all, you didn't talk about any of that. And here we are talking about this. It's going to be, and I think we're going to see some asterisks next to all that with your names there.
You know, my dad always felt like the story of America is the increasing widening of the circle of opportunity. Because you look through history, more and more people got access to the American dream. And it took a long time and a lot of fighting in order for that to happen. But one of the persistent groups that are still outside that circle of opportunity are people who are suffering from these illnesses. And so in a sense, this is a medical kind of version of civil rights, because we're trying to end this separate and unequal treatment of people simply because of their brain illness, just like we're trying to fight, bless you, discrimination on any other factor. So I grew up thinking everything had been done, you know, when I came along, like, President Kennedy, first president to address civil rights as a moral cause of his time. My Uncle Bobby, my dad, my Aunt Eunice doing Special Olympics. I mean, it was daunting. But I never imagined, I never went into public life to do this. So, I feel blessed that I'm in a place now where I can fight on this cause. And that connects me, by the way, to my family legacy of service. And it was only because I'm a Kennedy and I'm a member of Congress, I could do this stuff. And that I could call my dad to get the bill passed. Like, and I hate to say it, it wasn't some outcry, some march on Washington that got us to pass the parity. I called my dad and he said, call Chris Dodd. I called Chris Dodd and he said, what can I do? I said, H.R. 1424, I need you to get this off the Senate desk. He said, well, what's the problem? I said, it costs too much money. $35 billion on the Federal General Accounting Office cost estimate. And he said, well, let me see what I can do. A week and a half later, the stock market crashed. The banks went belly up. It was in 2008 where you were trying to get a job yourself. And Chris Dodd was now chairman of the banking committee. And Chris Dodd wrote the whole $800 billion toxic asset relief Economic Stabilization Act into H.R. 1424, the mental health parity, thereby ensuring its passage.
Wow.
So, you know, we're just, we're part of a bigger plan that we don't know the answers to. And I am so grateful I have the chance to pray and say, just make me of service. Because I never could have picked the life I have today. Never would have chosen to do this. And
ask what you can do for your country, for your community.
So I have a story that I have to share. Yeah. And so I live in this small town, Ashland, Wisconsin. And in the 1960s, Ashland, Wisconsin was... It had suffered from this toxic waste that was in the Bay of Lake Superior. The bay was red and from the 3M plant, and then white from the paper mills. And there was it was just a desolate, depressing place to live. And John Kennedy came there. He came there once in 1960, and he came there again in 1963. And his message, his 10-minute message to our community that continues to reverberate within our community, is that we're gonna clean up the environment and we're gonna bring jobs back to Ashland. He was not able to fulfill those promises. But you know what? He inspired all the people that were there. 8,000 people came to hear his speech that day. People still talk about that speech today.
Wow.
And you know what? We've cleaned up the bay. It is a beautiful place to live, and we're bringing vitality back to Ashland, Wisconsin. Okay. And I have no idea if that had happened had he not been there.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I think the point of that story is that we don't necessarily have to have all the details, everything worked out. We have to inspire people.
Yeah.
We have to inspire people. We can solve the overdose crisis. We can bring more resources to people with mental health disorder. This is just a matter of will. We can do this.
Totally.
We can do this.
Absolutely.
We can do this.
I love it.
We can change things.
Yes.
We can make things better for our kids.
Make that call. Write that chapter. Show up. Show up here, talk about things. I mean, I love hearing this. This is what City Club is all about, and this is what just bringing all these amazing people together. That's what we are here to do.
Well, thank you, Dan. Thank you, Jackie, and thanks everybody for being here and helping to make this possible.
Thank you, Peter and Mark, for your hospitality.
Yep.
It's a pleasure knowing you guys.
And there's so much more to come. And we had so many questions. I'd love to end right there because...
Well, the books are signed.
Oh, they are? Okay, great.
Obviously, I can personalize them, or I can make my flight out of.
Well, wait. I have a, okay, I have a question. Really, are you going to Midway, or are you going to O'Hare?
Whether I'm going to be able to tuck my kids in the bed tonight, or I'm going to be spending the night at O'Hare Airport. So no pressure.
No pressure.
I am. Thankfully, because of Peter, I'm here in Chicago quite a bit because we've done so much together. So. Hopefully you can help us with Kennedy Forum, Illinois, and we got a lot going on, and thank so many of you who've been helpful to us, and so I really appreciate this chance. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for being here.
That's right.
So much more to come. You'll have to come back again, and you're welcome anytime, and we really appreciate your courage and your stories and all of your advocacy efforts for your community, but really for the whole country, right? That didn't always do the right thing for you and your people. So this is really neat to see how you're taking that and making it a positive, just as the O'Briens have done, as Mark and all of you in this room have done. Thank you so much. Thank you, Patrick, for being here.
Thank you.
We'll give a few minutes back so everybody can get. Hopefully, you're not taking the Kennedy back home as you're or back up to the airport. It's under construction.
I don't know how John F. Kennedy does it. We're seeing everyone travels up and down your expressway. But I am,
Well, you're welcome back anytime, and we love having you here at City Club.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody.